Hey, how's it going, my friend? This is Jacob Laguerre, founder of PCI Institute, and today we're going to be going over the meta model. Now, back in the 1970s, Richard Bandler, one of the co-founders of NLP, and Frank Pusilek had learned this Gestalt therapy from his founder, Fritz Perls. Now, what happened is they ended up teaching it to some of the other students at the University of California, but what happened is they lacked the knowledge of the specific patterns being used. So in order to solve this, John Grinder, the other co-founder of NLP, was able to help them dissect the patterns being used by first modeling each of them. That way he can get an unconscious representation of the patterns. Now they continued their modeling work with Virginia Satir, who was also a world-renowned family therapist. And what's interesting is that they noticed an overlap with Fritz Perls' work. In 1975, The Structure of Magic was published, and the meta model was finally introduced for the first time. Now, interestingly enough, it was originally intended to be used by therapists, but it was found to have a wide range of applications, including business, personal development, coaching, consulting, and it was very flexible in that aspect. Now, real quick, I want to talk about the goal of the meta model. Now, essentially, the goal of the meta model is that we want to help someone point their consciousness in a much more useful directions. And what we do that is we treat the map or the statement, and you're going to notice I'm going to be using map and statement kind of interchangeably, so just kind of bear with me there. So we do that by treating the map or the statement as a whole map, and we ask questions that challenge the main idea behind that utterance or statement. Now, it's interesting that in The Structure of Magic, Bandler is going to actually make a distinction between the deep structure and the surface structure, which is actually two terms that they borrowed from transformational grammar. Now, the surface structure is the words and the utterance that someone says, and the deep structure is the pure experience that the surface structure is based upon. And by using the meta model challenge questions, which we're going to be going over, we're able to help someone connect to the deep structure while more resources are present. All right, so what I want you to do is I want you to start thinking of the meta model in terms of the compass. So you can see here over at the north end of the compass, we have generalizations, abstractions, and conclusions. And over at the bottom, we have the sensory specific information, the video description, and the type of stuff that if you were to hold like a video camera and record, we're talking about that kind of sensory data. So the thing is, every statement that we make is either going to be relatively specific or it's going to be relatively abstract, which is why we have these two poles right here, one over in the north and the other one in the south. Now, outside and inside, what does that mean exactly? So over here on the inside, we have what's called inside the map or the statement. Now, this is the type of information that a journalist will look for. So this is like the who, the what, the when, the where, the how, all that good stuff. And usually we can affirm this information from what someone has said. Now, over on the west side, we have the patterns that relate to what's outside of someone's map or model. And these are linguistic elements from inside of the map or model that someone can't really perceive. So as we're going through the mental model, I want you to keep this compass in mind because you're going to see how each pattern relates to this concept compass right here. So the first pattern we're going to be going over is called presuppositions. So you can see the presupposition is actually right in the middle. So there's also, you're going to see these patterns here. These patterns are neither on the inside or the outside of the map. I just want to throw that in there real quick. So over here we have from presuppositions. So pretty much the presuppositions, every statement that is made, every statement that you're going to see here in the meta model, all of these are presuppositions. Every statement is made that is a claim to knowledge. And like I said, all language patterns in the meta model act as presuppositions in the statement that is made. And what's interesting is that in The Structure of Magic, Bandler and Grinler outline 29 syntactic environments, which are pretty much places within an utterance or sentence where presuppositions may live. Now, we don't need to go over all 29 because that is a little bit of overkill. It kind of makes it seem like it's a lot more complicated. It really is. And pretty much the general idea behind presuppositions is that, you know, each statement is just a claim to knowledge. And that we have to presuppose there are certain things inside of a sentence in order for it to make sense. So just as a quick exercise for you, I'm going to give you a statement and I want you to presuppose what has to be there in order for this statement to make sense. So you ready? Here you go. The statement goes, the cat sat on the mat. Now, I want you to think about that statement for a second. Now, for starters, the first thing that we need to presuppose in that statement is that there's an entity called a cat. And then the next thing we got to presuppose in that sentence is that there's an object or an entity called Matt. And finally, we need to presuppose there's a relationship between those two entities called SAT. Now, because some presuppositions exist within every single utterance, we have it right here, right at the top of the mental model, the very tippity top. So next, we have a mind reading. Now, mind reading is pretty much just a claim that's made without stating how you know that claim per se. Now, in order to challenge this pattern, we just got to assume that in order for someone to make a claim, they have to have a way for making that claim. Now, you got to notice if someone is making a claim that's less than useful, it's not really helpful, or it's kind of just getting in the way, what you can do is you can ask someone for the foundation of that claim and make a change in how they think. Now, the challenge question for a mind reading pattern is simple, is simply this: how do you know? Whatever the question may be, I mean, or whatever the statement or the issue, the problem, just ask them, how do you know? And then from there, asking them how to know, it allows you to see exactly where they're drawing that information from. So we have it right here at the top right of our metamodel patterns. So next up, we got the lost performative. Now, lost performative is interesting because you see what happens is more often than not, we tend to drop who said it, when they said it, and under what conditions they said it. And what happens is when we fail to just find the scope of a statement, our nervous system, treats it as a universal. So it means essentially you treat that statement as something that's true at all times, all places, absolutely no exceptions. So what happens is when we go and we challenge the launch performative, challenging this pattern, it allows us to take a statement that's kind of just like kind of free floating or willy nilly and stuff, and we bring it back to a statement about a specific time, place, and reason. So very simply, to challenge a lost performative, you just simply ask, who says, or according to whom, or where did you get that from? And by doing that, you're able to help that person form a much more concrete representation of exactly what it is they're talking about. So next we have modal operators. So modal operators is down, is right below presuppositions, and it's right here in the middle. Pretty much modal operators describe the mode of operating in a sentence. And essentially it shows us the boundary of a map or model. Now, essentially, there's three types of modal operators. There's modal operators of possibilities, which are words such as can, could, may, and might. We also have the modal operators of necessity, which is should, like ought to, must, need to. We also got the modal operators of desirability, which is like love and like to. Now, it's interesting that depending on what a person's modal operators is used, we're able to figure out exactly how is it they motivate themselves. Some people are motivated by possibility, some by necessity, some by desirability. So now there's a conventional way to go about doing modal operators. So for example, if somebody says like I can't do something, like I can't give talks in publics, you can go a simple route. You can ask them very simply like what would happen if you could? And you say you can't do something, what would happen if you could? And by asking them what would you happen if you could, it allows us to helps us get information from what's outside of the map. Or you can respond with what stops you. Someone says they can't do something, ask them what stops you. And by doing that, it helps us get information from inside of the map. Now, these are just the two conventional approaches. You can also ask them, like, well, how do you know that you can? Which is the mind reading challenge question. Or you could ask them, well, according to whom? Which is the lost performative. And also another thing that's really interesting to note, when someone says that they can't do something, what they're really saying is, I can engage in the act of not doing X. Which is really interesting. In fact, let me just tell you a quick story while we're here. So there was actually a VP of communications from a really big company, and he was really, really afraid of giving talks in public. So one day he actually met with an NLP trainer, and he told him, I can't give talks in front of people. I just can't do it. So the NLP trainer asked him, well, how do you know that you can't? The VP said, well, I gave a couple of talks, and you know, I didn't really like how it turned out. So the trainer responded, okay, so you've given a couple of talks and, you know, you didn't really like the outcome. Have you ever gave a talk and, you know, it was neither here nor there? And the VP said, actually plenty of times. So now the NLP trainer says, well, we're actually no longer talking about if you can or can't now. Now the question is really of quality now. So what's interesting is when you hear modal operators around limitation, another good technique to do is to use counterexamples or just challenge the inferred or the implied universality inside of the statement. Now we're going to talk more about actually universals in the next section, which is coming up right about now. Universal qualifiers. So universal qualifiers, essentially they define the scope of the map. Now what's interesting about universal qualifiers, example of a universal qualifier could be every, all, and only, stuff like that. But what's interesting is that even if a person doesn't use those explicit words, they could still have a sort of inferred universality behind the statement. Like if someone doesn't offer a formal qualification, in other words, there's an implied or inferred universality to what they're saying. Now, here's the thing. In order for a statement with a universal qualifier to be valid, there can't exist a single, and I mean not one, counterexample. So very simply, if you want to challenge a universal qualifier, you simply just come up with a counterexample that could be true based on what the other person says. So next, we're going to be talking about cause and effect. The cause and effect, as you see, is inside of the map. And pretty much this gives us the structure for how the model works. So just a basic structure, if X and Y. And over on the X side, we have the sum total of evidence that points to Y as the outcome. Now, very simply, to go and challenge like cause and effects patterns, like I highly recommend taking a look at the sleight of mouth patterns. The sleight of mouth patterns are super powerful when it comes to handling cause and effect. But yes, definitely check that out because I actually do have an article on that. So next, we're going to be talking about nominalizations, which is over on the outside of the map. So pretty much, what's interesting is like nominalizations actually is a nominalization, you know, funny enough. But pretty much what a nominalization does is it allows us to take a complex activity and it puts it together into one thing. That way we're able to think about it. So very quickly, if you're trying to figure out whether or not a noun is a nominalization, there's a simple test called a wheelbarrow test. And very simply, any noun that you can put into a wheelbarrow is a nominalization. So just a couple of examples, you get education, you get conclusion, you get demonstration. You see, these are all nominalizations of educate, conclude, and demonstrate respectively. It's pretty much taking a verb and turning it into a noun. Now here's the thing. Now if you have a nominalization that's being problematic for you or for someone else, all you got to do is just put it back into verb form. Okay, so next we're going to be talking about predicates. So pretty much predicates are pretty much words that tells us something about the subject. And what's powerful about predicates is that we can use these words to influence what kind of representation someone makes in their mind. Now, there really is two main types of predicates. You get the time and the space predicates, and you also have the sensory predicates. So an example of a time predicate would be like before, look back, happen, and it pretty much allows you to place things like in terms of some modalities. And now, as for the sensory predicates, each sensory predicate actually corresponds to one of the representational systems. So you got visual predicates such as like review, out of sight, show me, auditory predicates like outspoken, shout, unheard of, and so on and so forth. So these words is just pretty much descriptive words that describe the subject. And we pretty much, like I said, we use these words to influence what kind of representations we make in someone's mind. So next, we got the complex equivalence pattern over on the inside of the map. Now this occurs when a person equates a particular qualitative word in their experience of the world around them. So what would be an example of a complex equivalence? So a complex equivalence could be as simple as this sentence: this day is lovely. So you see, this day is the actual experience, like the day, like we all know what a day experience is like, but saying lovely is it's a qualitative word. Like it can mean many things to many different people. So that's just a very simple example of what a complex equivalence is. So if you have a complex equivalence that's being problematic, very simply, you just ask a person how they equate the qualitative or the descriptive word with the world around them. You know, what's interesting is if you're watching the video right here, you'll notice that complex equivalence and nominalizations are actually on the same level of the meta model. You see, nominalization essentially describes the bits, and the complex equivalence shows how they all fit together. And just like with the cause and effect patterns, complex equivalents are definitely great. Like definitely check out the sleight of mouth patterns if you want to learn more about using different patterns or different strategies, so to speak, as well as like challenging at a complex equivalence. So next we have comparative deletions. So pretty much comparative deletions is based on this idea is that every evaluation that's been ever made, it comes from making comparisons to other things. So what's cool is that you can actually use this pattern even if there's no explicit mention of a comparison. And if there's no standard comparing mentioned in the map, all you can do is just simply ask about it. And by asking for a standard of a comparison, what you're able to do is you're able to sort out the relative difficulty for that person. So somebody could say, for example, like, yo, this test is really hard. And you can ask them, well, is hard compared to what exactly? Like, what are you comparing this hard test to exactly? So even though, like, I didn't make a comparison or anything, I just said, you know, this test is hard. You can still ask them to, like, say, what exactly are they comparing the hard test to exactly? Like, what is this hard compared to? Like, it's always about making comparisons. And by using this pattern, you're able to figure out exactly what it is they're comparing it to. So next, we get the lack of referential index. And that this is a language pattern where the who or the what they're speaking referring to isn't specified. So a quick example of a lack of referential, lack of referential index pattern is words like he, she, it, they. And very simply, to challenge the lack of referential index, you just ask who or what specifically. And pretty much what this does is it helps with gaining clarity on what the speaker is referring to. And this is over on the outside of the map. Okay, next we have non-referring nouns and unspecified verbs. Now it's interesting. Now the subject-verb relationship is extremely fundamental to the act of cognition. What happens is like we have this kind of hardwired to know exactly what something is and what it's doing. Now by challenging non-referring nouns, I kind of group these together because they're pretty much interlinked with one another. Challenging non-referring nouns, what it does is it helps us to give more information about who or what is being talked about. Now you might notice that when non-referring nouns, essentially the same language patterns that you use with the lack of referential index is what you use with non-referring nouns. They're very similar in that aspect, but with non-referring nouns, we're kind of just finding out more information about who is being talked about. With lack of referential index, it's just talking about who exactly is being referenced. So there's a slight difference there. Now with unspecified verbs, it was interesting to note that every verb is relatively unspecified. So very simply, like if you want to go and you want to get a little bit more clarity on an unspecified verb, you just challenge that by simply asking how specifically. Now it's also important to keep in mind that just because you collect more information about a verb, it doesn't necessarily provide more information about what's going on. So let me give you a quick example. Let's say like you're with a guy and this guy tells you, hey, my friend hit me. So you ask this guy and you say, well, how did your friend hit you? And the guy responds, well, she hit me hard. And you respond, well, with what? And he responds, well, with an idea. So you ask why? Why she hit you with an idea? He responds, because you're trying to help me. Now what you notice there was really interesting is isn't until the third question. It's not until the second question that we actually figure out that this person is talking about a metaphor. So that's the thing about when you're dealing with these bottom level, like a metamodel patterns, you can get very easily just lost up in a bunch of like nonsense and like data that's just really not useful. So it behooves you, I should say, to start at the top of the metamodel. From here, you're able to affect the map on a much more profound level rather than starting at the bottom when you're just trying to pick up information. It can get really messy. There's that. So next, frame of reference. Now, to change someone's mind, you have to, and I repeat, you have to consider their frame of reference. Now, you see, when you're speaking with someone, and it could be anybody, it could be your friends, your family, whatever. When you're speaking with someone, they're making references within their own worldview to a particular set of representations. Now, you got to understand, in order to change someone's mind, you're going to need some tools to help them shift that frame of reference. Now, it just so happens we have some tools for you, and that tool is called the framing tool. Now, very simply, the framing tool is just like the metamodel compass that we had gone over originally. The only thing is we're just adding the dimension of time. So once we add a dimension of time, we have them the framing tool. So pretty much you have right here is the issue or whatever the statement is. And at the top here, you have the purposes, the intentions, worldview. So very similar to like with the metamodal compass. And down here, we have the evidence, the sensory details, the examples, you know, the really granular details. And then going into the past, we have the influences, the precedences, states that led to the statement. And then from the statement moving forward into the future, we have the consequences, we got the futures, and we got the outcomes. So essentially what the framing tool does is it helps us with figuring out which is the best frame of reference to approach the issue or the statement. So that way we can have the best chance at creating the most effective change. So inoculation. So here's this concept of inoculation. So you see, like just like I was saying earlier, people are going to constantly filter what you're saying through their own understandings, expectations, or hopes or fears, and all that stuff. Now here's the thing: if you can't find a way to contextualize what's going on in those filters, what's happening is you're going to set yourself up for a lot of failure and frustration. So what you want to do is you want to bring up anything that could be a potential problem and create a way for people to deal with it before it becomes a bigger problem later on in the future. Actually, I'm reminded of this story. So you see, there was actually an NLP trainer that was once hired to do some work for a really, really big financial firm. And one day he actually met the two of the senior executives, and they actually had some really concerned looks on their faces. And the executives told the NLP trainer that the group that he would be training had been very unkind to the previous consultants. And they told him, like, you know what, these guys, they chewed them up and spat them out. It was terrible. Now, later that day, the NLP trainer actually went back to his hotel, and he actually took some time to think about like what had to be going on in these people's heads in order to make those behaviors the right one. Now, we knew that the group had a minimum of like, say, 10 to 15 years of experience, and some had even ran businesses making anywhere from $100 million to $500 million per year. So he figured out if someone were to patronize him or to lord over him and that stuff, or that kind of stuff, he knew that could be one possible reason why they'd be hostile to someone. So he ended up thinking of like a few more possibilities, you know, and he called it a night. So the next day he met with the managing director and he walked him into the room. The managing director introduced him to the room of like these top level people, and he was left alone. So NLP trainer went and did an inoculation. He went and started off by saying, you know what, before we begin, there's a number of things I'd like to acknowledge. Now, I know that most of you have far more experience than I do, and I'm really not here to tell you how to do your job better. Now, I know there's some very unique competencies here in this room, and each of you is here for a reason. I know you guys are already successful. I'm just here to bring you some information, you know, you might not have heard of. And I also have some things that can help anyone. Now, I'm not asking for your immediate compliance or to believe everything I say, but in fact, I even invite your skepticism. But there is one thing you do need to know before you start. I've already been paid, and for the next few days, we can either work great, we can either work enjoyably and make this great for all of us, or we can be miserable. It's your choice. And what was interesting was as he was saying this and he was inoculating everyone, he was just noticing how everybody was just reacting. Like some people started smiling, others were nodding their heads in agreement. And even when he had mentioned a part about already being paid and stuff, like people just started laughing. It was incredible. And after his speech, he went through his agenda. And, you know, they went off, they did their thing. And at the end of the day, the managing director actually pulled the NLP trainer aside and asked him, what did you do differently? Like, what happened here? And he responded, I just didn't step on their toes. So it's pretty powerful. And also another thing too, if you do suspect there's a certain attitude about a situation, what you can do is you can just go and you can just create a caricature out of it. The only thing though, when you create a caricature out of a situation, you want to go and you want to offer a viable alternative for it. So next, now I'm going to talk about changes people's mind. Now we're really cooking with gas now. Oh boy. So what changes people's minds, every question that you ask is going to point someone's consciousness in one direction or another. So you want to be very conscious about the questions that you're asking. You see, even the way that you ask a question is going to have a radical, and I mean a radical impact on how the other person understands the question and where they go to access the information. And you also need to think about what category of answers you want, and you need to use presuppositions to elicit them out of people. So let me give you a question. So let me give you an example. So consider these two questions. So imagine if I ask you, if your income doubles, what would you do with it? And just think about that for a second. If your income doubles, what would you do with it? Now, if you're like most people, if you thought about that, you probably thought about the types of things or the type of material possessions you could buy with that increase in money. Now, imagine I ask you this question. What would doubling your income do for you? It's a very different question. You see, now you're not thinking about materials. You're probably thinking about like how it will make you, how it help you with like relieving some pressure, or maybe might help you pay some bills off. You see, it kind of makes you tap into a different part of your mind. And that's what I mean when I say that the types of questions that you ask is going to trigger the types of categories of answers that you receive. So you want to be very conscious about that. And also, before you ask any question whatsoever, you always want to first determine whether the frame of reference you're using is the correct one. Now, usually you can determine the correct frame of reference. Usually that's going to be the client that helps you determine it, but it also can depend on what you've been asked to do, as well as your belief on the problem. So from there, we just use a framing tool to find a particular frame of reference that's solvable, so that way we can help that client move on, or if it's just for yourself, you can help yourself move on from this problem just by shifting your frame of reference and being able to look at things a little bit differently. So I just want to say thank you for taking the time to watch this, or if you're listening to this on a podcast, just want to thank you for taking the time to listen to this. Actually, I want to give you a free PDF version of the metal model. That's way you can just read this on the go. All you got to do is go to PCIinstitute.net/meta-model-PDF. All you got to do is enter your email, and I'm going to have that sent over to you right away. Now, if you're watching this on YouTube, you can just check the description down below and just click on that link. Or if you're listening to this on the podcast, all you got to do is just check out the show notes where I have the link posted in there as well. But once again, it's PCIinstitute.net/meta-model-PDF. So yes, I just want to say thank you for taking the time to watch this or to listen to this, however you are consuming this content. Once again, this is Jacob Laguerre, founder of PCI Institute, signing off. Thanks for stopping by, and I will catch you next time. Peace.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.